Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oil prices have been stuck at $60 for a while now, give or take a couple of dollars either way. But ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson said today he thinks that's probably a little high, that there's a $15 or $20 premium built in just because people are nervous. So the world's largest publicly traded oil company is going to go exploring. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's March 7th today, Wednesday. Great to have you here. ExxonMobil chairman and CEO Rex Tillerson was making the rounds in New York today, trying to drum up publicity for the company's big announcement. Exxon's going to spend about $20 billion a year through the end of the decade drilling for new oil and natural gas. The oil giant says the new projects could boost production by about 1 million barrels a day. But Sam Eaton reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk there's much less to the news than meets the eye.
Exxon told analysts in New York this morning that it will spend record amounts of money opening more than 20 new global projects over the next 3 years. The announcement comes on the heels of growing criticism that the oil giant isn't spending enough to boost reserves in the face of record profits. But Barbara Shook with the Energy Intelligence Group in Houston says the details of Exxon's plans are nothing new.
They're just making more of a public presentation of what it was going to do anyway.
Shook says the real question is whether Exxon will be able to deliver on those projects, given geopolitical uncertainty and the increased costs of extraction.
We have seen projects balloon 2 to 3 times their original investments in a matter of 2 or 3 years.
Even Exxon, which spends more on research and development than any of its competitors, admits it's being selective. A company spokesman says there's no shortage of opportunity, but it wants to ensure that the projects it does pursue will have a good rate of return for its investors. Stephen Lieb, author of The Oil Factor, says that's exactly why Exxon is spending more on shareholder buybacks than it is on new exploration.
If they're so bullish on oil in the world, that just doesn't make any sense at all. You would expect them to be putting all their excess cash into finding additional sources of oil.
Lieb says even if Exxon does add another 1 million barrels to its daily output, much of that would be natural gas, not the stuff needed to meet the projected 40% rise in global oil demand over the next 2 decades. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
The United Nations has been leaning on Iran to freeze its uranium enrichment program. But while the UN has been turning up the diplomatic and economic pressure, it has consciously steered clear of Iran's biggest asset, oil. Today, the Iranian parliament turned up the heat on its own. It raised the price of heavily subsidized gasoline from 34 cents a gallon to about 50 and moved toward rationing supplies. There are still a few bureaucratic steps to go, but Iranians could soon be paying more and getting less. We called reporter Roxana Saberi to see how this is going over in Tehran. Roxana, hello.
Hello.
Isn't Iran one of OPEC's largest oil producers? And if so, why does the government feel the need to ration gasoline?
Iran is, as you said, one of OPEC's largest oil producers. It's OPEC's second largest oil producer and the fourth largest oil producer in the world. But the problem that exists, according to a lot of economists, is that gas has just been too inexpensive, and it has caused them to consume a lot of gasoline, and the increase in their gas consumption has been about 10% a year, which is quite a lot. And it has to import actually 40% of that, even though it has such high oil reserves. And so the government ends up paying a lot of money for all this, billions of dollars every year for gas imports. While it has subsidized gas at home, it has encouraged smuggling of gasoline to neighboring countries, and not to mention it's also terrible for the pollution.
There is all this domestic oil production. Why, then, do they have to import gas? Are there no refining stations in Iran?
There are refineries here, but there's not enough refining capacity. There have been several reasons for this. One is during the Iran-Iraq War during the 1980s, a lot of those refineries were damaged, so it took time for Iran to rebuild some of them. Also, perhaps domestic policies in terms of the conditions that foreign investors get for for investing in these refineries.
What's the reaction been today on the streets when people heard about this increase in prices and a tightening of supply?
A lot of ordinary Iranians are not happy about an increase in prices, but some other Iranians say that it's necessary because they also agree that it has led to a lot of waste. I think the major dissatisfaction will happen. One, it depends on what the quota will be set at, how many liters of gasoline Iranians will be able to pay at the lower price before they have to pay a higher price if they go beyond that quota, and also if it will lead to inflation in other areas of the economy.
What's the domestic political implication here? Didn't President Ahmadinejad come to power in part at least on the oil wealth and promising to share it with the population?
He did. He made a lot of promises, and some Iranians believe that he still needs time to implement them, but others are dissatisfied. And actually, I think historically, Iranians have had this expectation that because their country is so rich in resources, why should they have to pay high prices for gas at the pumps?
If you went out on the street today and asked people what they thought about the Iranian economy, what would they say?
Well, I don't think that I have ever heard anybody here say that the economy is in a good situation or that it's getting better. And I don't know if this is something that's part of their outlook or part of their culture to kind of complain about the economy. But I do have to say that the economy is facing a lot of challenges here, too. Iran's economy has a lot of potential. There are a lot of young people who are educated, they're trained, there are a lot of natural resources here, etc. But Iran's just not tapping into this potential. There's a lot of inflation, 15% to 16% a year, and a lot of people are working 2 to 3 jobs and they say they just can't make ends meet.
Roxana Saberi in Tehran, Iran. Roxana, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
On Wall Street today, things were moving right along till just about an hour before the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There were two interesting reports out from the Federal Reserve today. The central bank released what's commonly called the beige book after the color of its cover. The regional survey of the U.S. economy showed exactly what Chairman Ben Bernanke's been saying, moderate growth in most places. And the Fed issued its consumer credit report. We owe a combined $2.4 trillion as of the end of January, not counting mortgages. A good part of that debt's on credit cards. And at a congressional hearing in Washington today, executives from some of the biggest credit card companies found themselves on the defensive over their fees and interest rates. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Take the case of Wesley Wanamaker of Lima, Ohio. He used a new Chase credit card in 2001 to run up $3,200 in expenses, mostly for his wedding. After some health problems, he soon became overwhelmed with fees, penalties, and interest rates nearing 30%. Over the next 6 years, he paid $7,500 and still owed more than $4,000 when he contacted the Senate Committee on Investigations.
It feels like every month you take one step forward but two steps back. You watch that 30% and the other fees just continue to grow your balance.
After the committee came calling, Chase wiped Wanamaker's bill clean, and at today's hearing, CEO Richard Srednicki apologized.
We have policies and procedures in place at Chase to identify customers like him who have fallen into deep financial trouble and are finding it difficult to work their way out. In this case, we simply blew it.
Banks defend their credit card fees as fair compensation for the lending risks they take. But consumer groups complain fees, late charges, and interest rate adjustments are not clearly disclosed. And Republican Senator John Warner of Virginia warned credit card issuers that government regulations are in the offing.
Congress is going to police this thing pretty severely and clean it up.
That could include caps on fees, limits on interest rates, and better disclosure of the real costs of using a credit card. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Internet broadcasters were on Capitol Hill today as well. They were warning lawmakers about a sharp increase in federally mandated music royalties they say could drive them out of business. The music industry says it's only looking for fair compensation for its artists and recording labels. Marketplace's Bob Moon has more.
Let's just say you have different musical tastes, and at long last, You've been able to find what you're looking for.
We're going to listen to some gypsy music here.
Only on the internet.
KCRWmusic.com.
Ruth Seymour is manager of LA area public radio station KCRW. She reacted in mock horror today when I told her I'd been listening to one of the station's web channels.
Get off the music site. You're costing money.
A new ruling from three judges who make up the Copyright Royalty Board could prove costly indeed. David Oxenford is an attorney representing independent web broadcasters. He says fees on some smaller outfits are set to double or triple this year.
They simply don't make enough money to pay those royalties. These royalties will be several hundred percent of their total revenues.
KCRW's Ruth Seymour remains hopeful public radio stations might collectively be able to bargain for a better deal.
Having introduced a lot of new artists, which then went on to sign with record labels and made them quite a bit of money, we're valuable to these people.
At Sound Exchange, an organization set up by the recording industry to collect music royalties, Director John Simpson agrees there might be room for some sites to negotiate.
I think there is the ability for them to go to a group of copyright owners and say, hey, we're different, and we need a different license, and can you accommodate us?
But Simpson also points out electricity generally costs all customers the same, and that, he says, is how the free market is supposed to operate. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
You know those signs in restaurant bathrooms that say employees have to wash their hands before returning to work? One, you'd hope they'd do that anyway. And two, that might not be enough anymore, at least in Los Angeles. Food service workers here could be facing mandatory hepatitis A vaccinations. County supervisors have voted to see how much that might cost following news that a cook working for Wolfgang Puck's catering company was infected. There are something like 25,000 places to eat in this city and maybe a couple of 100,000 people working in them. So the vaccines would be a pretty tall order. And Helen Palmer reports from the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH, it might not even be worth it.
The man in the hot seat to decide what to do is Jonathan Fielding. He's Los Angeles County Public Health Director, and he says there are a lot of worried Angelenos.
People were calling all the restaurants. Some were canceling bookings. They were worried about the prepackaged food that has Wolfgang Puck's name on it.
Fielding stresses nobody's become sick yet, but there's a good case for vaccinating food workers if the economics can be worked out.
And that's one of the issues we're going to look at, both overall costs and who would pay. Is probably around $25 for Hep A inoculation.
In Las Vegas, food service workers must have health cards certifying they're vaccinated against hepatitis A. The cards cost $40. An outbreak could be costly. Protective shots for people exposed cost up to $50 each. Bill Mahler, a lawyer who represents food poisoning victims, remembers what happened in 2003 in Pennsylvania.
In the Chi-Chi's hepatitis case, that was 10,000 people that got that shot. That restaurant, because of a hepatitis A outbreak, went bankrupt.
So it could be worth it for restaurants to pay up for vaccination, says Bob Golden. He's a restaurant analyst with Technomic.
I think this is an investment, not a cost. You're buying an insurance policy.
Still, Golden points out restaurants prefer to self-regulate and oppose extra spending on workers who change jobs frequently. Meanwhile, a CDC report from 2001 concluded that vaccinating restaurant employees is unlikely to be economical from either the restaurant owner or the societal perspective. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
President Bush will spend most of the next week getting on and off Air Force One. He leaves tomorrow for a six-day, five-night stay in Latin America, five countries in all. But it's the one the president's not going to that everybody's talking about. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is trying to expand his influence in the region by giving away oil money. President Bush, on the other hand, won't have it quite so easy. From the Marketplace America's desk at WLRN in Miami, Dan Gretsch reports.
President Bush's foreign policy in Latin America can pretty much be summed up in two words, free trade. Since he came to office, his administration signed 10 free trade deals. Meanwhile, Bush's rival, Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, has given out billions in cash.
Latin America's happy to take the money. Why not take the money?
Susan Purcell's with the University of Miami. She says there's a simple reason the U.S. doesn't simply hand out cash like Venezuela. It tried that already. President Kennedy's Alliance for Progress poured $22 billion into the region.
during the days when the United States was handing out a lot of money in Latin America, everyone said, fine, you know, they can't buy us. Maybe they could rent us temporarily, but they can't buy us. And I think Chavez will find the same thing.
Since the Cold War, the U.S. has taken a different approach. In the 90s, it formed the so-called Washington Consensus to endorse a package of tough love free market reforms. But most Latin Americans never felt the trickle-down. The region still has the worst income inequality in the world. Dan Griswold's with the Cato Institute. He says free trade is still the best medicine.
Look at the Latin American countries that have stuck to the reform path, Mexico and Chile, El Salvador, Peru, and some other countries. They are doing better. Free trade requires some patience. It doesn't deliver funds instantly overnight, and yet there's a proven track record.
But delayed gratification is a harder sell than free oil. Andres Oppenheimer is a syndicated columnist with the Miami Herald.
Free trade diplomacy doesn't have a chance with oil diplomacy because oil diplomacy is cash in hand. Free trade diplomacy is a promise that if you do this, eventually you'll be better off.
Analysts say Latin America is increasingly split in two. On one side, you have the countries that cut trade deals with the U.S., such as Mexico, Colombia, and Guatemala, three stops on Bush's trip. On the other, you have allies of Venezuela that focus on regional cooperation and lifting the poor. Peter Hakam directs the Inter-American Dialogue, a think tank in Washington, D.C. He says the U.S. needs to hit the social agenda harder to keep more countries from slipping to Venezuela's side.
The U.S.'s agenda for Latin America is not wrong. It's too narrow. Trade doesn't confront the vast inequalities in the region. Those have to be addressed more directly.
Bush hopes to sway some countries still on the fence, like Brazil and Uruguay. And to do that, he's borrowing a page from the playbook of his arch rival, Fidel Castro. On Monday, Bush offered free health care to 12 countries.
In June, I'm going to send one of our Navy's medical ships, the Comfort, to the region. Altogether, the Comfort's doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals expect to treat 85,000 patients and conduct up to 1,500 surgeries.
In his speech, Bush blurred the lines between his social agenda and that of his communist rivals.
Nearly one out of four people in Latin America lives on less than $2 a day. This is a scandal, and it's a challenge.
He even invoked Chavez hero Simón Bolívar, but in the name of another revolution, the free market revolution. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Coming up, China plays hardball.
For China, economic security and military security go hand in hand. Both are part of the same strategy to make China a superpower.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial slipped 15 points today, a tenth of 1% to close at 12,192. The Nasdaq slumped 10 points, 0.4% to wind up the day at 2374. The S&P 500 lost 3 points, that's about a quarter of 1%, ended the day at 1391. Exxon and Chevron each bubbled up about 1% as prices for crude oil rose. Some subprime mortgage lenders continued to regain their footing. Fremont General marched up 25%. New Century Financial gained 2.75%. Novastar Financial rocketed up 12%. American Eagle Outfitters peeled off 2.8%. The retailer said fourth quarter profits jumped 40%, but their first quarter guidance didn't meet expectations. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 4.49%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. And by American Public Media, announcing the important new book, Speaking of Faith, by public radio host Krista Tippett, in bookstores everywhere now. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. President Bush departs for his trip to South and Central America and the Caribbean. First stop, Brazil. The nation's largest retailers report sales figures for February. And it's the anniversary of an American tradition, U.S. income tax, established on March 8, 1913. A reminder to get your paperwork in order for filing next month. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The president's going to South America to talk trade, as we mentioned a moment ago. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's already in Asia doing the same thing. He had some quick meetings in Beijing today. Tomorrow, Paulson will make a big speech at the Shanghai Futures Exchange, where he's expected to say it's time for China to get serious about opening its markets. Marketplace's Scott Tong is in Shanghai. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Kai.
You know, we had the show in Shanghai a year ago, and you and I have both spent some time there, and we both know that you can get almost anything you want in that city. So what is Henry Paulson talking about when he says China is closed to foreign competition?
What he's talking about is banking and financial services. As you say, you can get all manner of foreign products here, consumer products and clothes and cell phones and watches. A big exception is banking. If you look up and down the streets, there are a whole lot of ATMs in Shanghai, but almost all of them are Chinese domestic banks. And Mr. Paulson's point will be, look, competition has served China well in so many areas of the economy. It will serve China well in banking as well. Here is how Lester Ross puts it. He's an attorney up in Beijing, and he works for multinational companies.
If China really wants to move into the major leagues, if it wants Shanghai to become an international financial capital, it can't say, well, we're only going to let you in baby steps. You have to do it all the way. And places that don't do so remain secondary cities.
Well, Scott, what does the Chinese government say when people accuse them of maintaining closed markets?
Well, they deny the accusation. They say that as of this past December, that they've lifted all the legal restrictions. Now, the foreign banks come back and say, well, in reality, if you think about how the bureaucratic process works in China, that's not the case. Let me just give you an example. If a Chinese national walks into a foreign bank branch in Shanghai and wants to open up a checking account, that person has to cough up $120,000 just to kind of get in the door, which means that there's not going to be a whole lot of people who are going to want to set up these accounts because they're just not wealthy enough. That's just one example where the door is barely open for them.
What's the government afraid of then?
They're afraid that their banks won't be able to compete with the foreign banks. And at the center of all this is Chinese lending practices. Do you ever have any friends who you loan money to and they promise they would give it back because they're your friend and they never did?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a whole lot of that going on in China. You know, the economists call it non-performing loans, where their loans go bad. And it's because a lot of the lending is based on personal relationships.
Let's get this back to Henry Paulson. Frame this for me in terms of the bilateral U.S. relationship, the trade gap, and worries in this country about the revaluation of the yuan, the Chinese currency.
Well, Mr. Paulson has said in recent days that the U.S. is dissatisfied with the pace at which China is revaluing its currency. He's thrown out the word protectionism when it comes to the trade relationship. There's just a sense, and there's always a sense, that it's not happening fast enough. Now, the answer from China and China watchers is economic reform has always gone kind of slow and steady in China, and it's worked very well. So they're not going to want to introduce a whole lot of economic shocks into the system, fling open the doors to the banks, or jack up the value of the currency very quickly. That, in their minds, translates into potential economic instability, social and political instability, and at the root of all this is political self-preservation for them.
Scott Tong is Marketplace's man in Shanghai. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Kai.
Of course, it's not all about business and economic growth in China. Earlier this week, Beijing announced it'll increase military spending almost 18% this year to about $45 billion. That's about a tenth of what the Pentagon gets, but it was still enough to get some attention in Washington. And commentator Robert Reich explains that's just what the Chinese wanted.
One clue is that China's announcement of its military buildup comes the same week Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson is scheduled to visit, presumably to continue pressing China to raise the value of its currency in light of the huge and growing trade imbalance with America. You see, for China, economic security and military security go hand in hand. Both are part of the same strategy to make China a superpower. Maintaining its current 10% yearly growth rate necessitates reliable supplies of oil, natural gas, and other raw materials from all over the world, as well as the latest technologies. And China also needs growing export markets to absorb its increasing production and provide jobs to the tens of millions of its people migrating from the countryside. All this, in China's view, necessitates being able to play power politics, both with Middle East and Russian oil producers, when and if tensions arise over energy supplies. And China needs to be able to flex its muscle with Japan, Europe, and America in the competition for energy and other critical raw materials, as well as continue to have access to technologies these nations possess. And it needs to keep its access to these hugely important markets. So China's military buildup isn't a direct threat to the U.S. Power politics in today's world doesn't require the direct exercise of military power so much as the capacity to pressure other major powers indirectly. For example, credibly threatening to use force against Taiwan, or selling advanced weapons systems to developing nations, or, in the case of North Korea, becoming the source of food and weapons. Sound familiar? China is not inventing this strategy of combining economic power with military power. It's following in the footsteps of the nation that wrote the playbook on how it's done, the United States. That's why China's military announcement was timed to coincide with Hank Paulson's visit, and why Paulson's economic mission may be lost in translation.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He used to be the labor secretary for President Clinton. Tomorrow, we'll have a different view of China's economic power. Until then, if you'd like to send us your thoughts, head to our website. The address is marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, managing investments for the long term with a consistent, disciplined approach. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. 1-877-T-ROWE-PRICE. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, there have been a lot of questions out there about whether or not the U.S. housing market has hit bottom yet. We've got two opinions to offer. Today, former Federal Reserve Chief Alan Greenspan said, yep, he thinks we're all done dropping. But D.R. Horton's CEO Donald Tomnitz has another perspective. D.R. Horton's the second largest luxury home builder in this country. And Tomnitz said today 2007's going to stink. He didn't actually say stink. He used that other S word that your mom really doesn't like. But he also said his losses are going to continue into 2008. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow down 15 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ lost about 10 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 dropped 3 points. That's 0.25% there. Our engineers include Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, and Joel Stein. Next time, the candy industry is in a decidedly bitter fight to lower the cost of sugar.
You could even go down to 0.1%, 0.5%. I mean, really, at this point, the insurance costs are not going to go down. Our workman's comp is not going to go down. Our energy costs are through the roof. Every single savings in cost, even with pennies, is significant.
I'm Kai Verizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.